May be seated. Our third case this morning is 11-2040, Jeff Holmes versus Crawford Machine and State of Ohio BWC. The appellant is Ms. Lothar.
Yes. Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices, may it please the court, my name is Jennifer Lothar. I'm an attorney with Nagel, Romain & Schneiberg, and I represent appellant Jeff Holmes. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We're here on the certified conflict between Holler and Holmes, dealing with the question, does the trial court abuse its discretion under revised code 4123.512F by taxing opposing party attorney's fees and costs that are strictly related to unsuccessful claims? The proper answer to this question is no. For two reasons. One is based on the purpose of the statute, and two is based on the inability to apportion fees and costs between multiple conditions.
Counsel, just as a factual background, would the abrasion on the finger have constituted a, would you have needed expert testimony? If that were the only claim, would he have needed expert testimony in order to participate?
I believe in this case it would have, and the reason for that is because this was a highly contested matter. In fact, the appellee put on two doctors to talk about this case. So in this case, I do believe it would have, Your Honor.
I don't mean this. Okay, but you're talking.
But you're talking about an abrasion in general.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose that, in my opinion, an abrasion actually is a medical diagnosis, and because that was the condition that was found by the Industrial Commission, then yes, you would. Because I don't think an average layperson would necessarily know what an abrasion is. They would know what a cut is. They would know what a scrape is. They would know what requires a Band-Aid. But would they truly understand what an abrasion is?
And in this case, there, when I was reading one of the briefs, the abrasion they only required a Band-Aid, right? There was the allegation of the electrical shock.
Correct, Your Honor.
Which the employer presented evidence. The machine did not do that. I guess that was a disputed fact. But what was sustained was an abrasion. So was the skin broken? Are we talking about a bruise? What was the injury that was sustained by the jury?
By the injured worker?
Uh-huh.
That the jury found was abrasion.
And what was the extent of the abrasion? Was there a broken skin?
I believe that there was broken skin and there was blood.
But a Band-Aid would have cured it?
At the time of the initial injury, yes. When somebody suffers such an injury as an abrasion or even a contusion, you don't know what that might lead to. You know, any time that there's a break in the skin, for instance, you could develop a staph infection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at that point that the claim is filed, you don't know what will come from that.
Was there medical expert testimony as to this finger?
Dr. Zawasi was the person who testified on behalf of appellant, and he did not render an opinion regarding the abrasion and the causal connection, but he did define what an abrasion is, as well as provided testimony to the jury when it came to what his qualifications were, what the background of the injury was, and so on.
Okay. And how many claims were disallowed?
There were 6 total, and there were 5 that were disallowed.
Okay. And the disallowed were which ones?
More significant injuries than an abrasion.
Okay.
The Workers' Compensation Act, I would like the justices to keep in mind, as a compromise between employees to have coverage when injured at work and employers to have immunity from civil liability. The statute has a very specific provision under 4123.95, which requires the act to be liberally construed in favor of employees. With this in mind, the purpose of 4123.512F is to minimize the actual expense incurred by an injured worker who wins at trial. The one thing I'd like you to keep in mind, in this particular case, the employer appealed this to court. So what that means is that the injured worker had no choice but to go to trial. On the other hand, when a claimant appeals it to court, an employer is not required to go to court because the administrator steps in. So on one, depending on who appeals to court, limits where you have to defend or where you don't have to defend. In this case, the claimant had to defend. In fact, he had to reprove his case because he had won administratively. And just also to keep in mind, which I'm sure you're aware, that it's the court's role to interpret the statute, not to legislate it. And you must give effect to the plain meaning of the statute, even if you might believe it results in an unfavorable outcome.
When you were at trial, before the judge entered the award for expert witness fees, was there a motion made by the employer's counsel to apportion those fees to the injury found by the jury?
There was not a hearing held. That motion for fees and costs was filed after the jury verdict was rendered and after the judgment entry was rendered. And then there was a motion in opposition to that filed, and then the judge entered his decision. There was a motion for reconsideration done, and that was denied.
Was there not a hearing held? Was there this specific issue raised before the trial court, that the fee should be apportioned based on one of six injuries being sustained?
I believe that may have been in their motion for reconsideration or motion in opposition. So, and keep in mind, too, the trial judge in this case, the same judge who tried this case is the judge who ordered 100% of the fees and costs, okay? So he's well aware of all the circumstances of this case and what type of effort was expended for attorney's fees, what type of costs were necessary to prove the abrasion claim.
But the legal issue before us is really the conflict between the appellate jurisdictions. Could you address that? Because the legal issue is, if you win on one of six, are you entitled to a proportionate share of the maximum as to that claim that you prevailed on, or are you entitled to an equal based on the fact that you prevailed?
It's my opinion that the statute states right to participate. In this case, Mr. Holmes was found the right to participate. The statute does not state he has to have been found the right to participate for all conditions requested. It states the right to participate. He was found the right to participate.
But aren't the expenses and fees related to the claims on which you prevailed? Isn't that what the statute says? Isn't there qualifying language?
The statute says that
certified question relates to subsection F, and
correct.
F has some language in there as to the award being related to the claims upon which the claimant prevailed.
Correct.
Some words to that effect.
And it's my position that you can't apportion or you can't allocate, okay? Because let's flip that, okay? Let's say that, you know, I try 10 conditions. Well,
if you had prevailed on all six conditions, we likely wouldn't be here.
Well, that's true, too, Your Honor.
Having prevailed on a cut finger but having lost on more substantial injuries, to use your phrase, one would think that Crawford Machine prevailed and therefore would not be as liable for expenses and fees as if they had not prevailed on all of those claims.
But, Your Honor, it's my position that you cannot apportion or allocate, and the statute does not require you to.
Okay,
likewise,
so help us understand why you are correct on that.
Sure.
Can you give us...
I'll give you some examples, actually.
Give us
like.
Your argument and the law is what we're interested in.
Okay. Well, first off, when it comes to, for instance, attorney's fees, okay, if I'm successful on 10 conditions, the statute doesn't say I get $42,000 in attorney's fees. I'm capped at $4,200 regardless of the number of conditions that are won, lost, or whatever. It's the right to participate. There are some cases that deal with when you have multiple conditions and you have expert testimony. And those cases really were limited to an expert witness's fee, okay, as well as that's part of what the Third District found here. When it comes to the expert witness fee, it's whether can you allocate that between multiple conditions or can you not, okay? It's my position that you cannot allocate this. And there's case law that supports this out of numerous districts, well, at least three that I can think off the top of my head, that state you can't allocate that.
Counsel?
Yes.
I think we can see what was before the trial judge. The trial judge simply read the statute.
Correct.
Said it was determined that your client was entitled to participate in the fund.
Correct.
And did not parse then the which witnesses were on which conditions and those kinds of things. My question is, at the outset, when Crawford decided to put this in play, is it possible to acknowledge certain conditions they agree are related to the claimed injury and appeal only on some medical conditions that the claimant is claiming entitlement to participate in the fund? And in other words, could they have left this issue of the finger, the damaged finger, behind and said, that one's all okay, we don't dispute it? Or was the nature of their claim that there was no work-related injury at all? Is that what the trial was about?
The trial was predominantly about whether there was a work-related injury or not. They did not believe that Mr. Holmes was injured on the job. Yet their own witnesses testified about this finger injury. Okay, so yes, they could have conceded the abrasion prior to having a trial on the issue of abrasion and tried the other conditions. But they did not.
So it's possible to sort of split the baby,
so to speak. And there actually was a district court where this came up when it came to attorney's fees, where there was a conceded issue prior to trial, and then there was a trial on one of the issues that was lost. You know, and what do you do in that, you know, situation? And, you know, in that situation, you know, they still found that there should be attorney's fees and costs. Further, when it comes to allocating, you can't have a uniform rule. You know, some cases may be cut and dry. You have two conditions, you have two experts, okay? So one expert testifies on one condition, the other on the other condition, and you lose one and win one. Well, that's easy when it comes to the expert witness fee in that scenario. But what if you have one expert who testifies on two conditions? You can't say half his fee was for one condition and half was for the other, because when you look at an expert witness's testimony, it's not just about the medical conditions. It's about their qualifications. It's about the history of the injury, the history of prior medical treatment, as well as a very limited portion actually deals with the causal relationship from the work injury to the medical condition. And it's simply, you can't do a uniform rule that will apply across the board. It's my opinion that's why the legislature did what they did, and they simply left it to right to participate.
Counsel, doesn't it say, though, that the trial court shall fix the amount? And doesn't that suggest that the trial court needs to look at the circumstances involved and potentially allocate?
And again, I believe that when it comes to the trial court, it says shall, which means that they have to do it. And in this case, the court did do that based on the circumstances of this case and did not abuse its discretion.
It says to be fixed by the trial judge based upon effort expended.
I believe that part, and correct me if I'm wrong, when it comes to the attorney's fees.
All right, the cost of the proceedings, including attorney's fees.
Correct.
Under F.
Okay.
So you're saying that they're just everything all the time, if there's like in this case a bandaged finger, and that's what the jury found was the injury, all of the expense and all of the attorney's fees are to be awarded.
Correct, Your Honor, because you can't base the statute. It doesn't anywhere say that it needs to be based on the severity of an injury. So I would advise, hopefully the court will not get stuck on that, and they will answer the certified question, no, that the trial court did not abuse its discretion. I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
All right.
Ms. Erdman?
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, the Employers Council, Barb Knapik, and I will be dividing our time evenly. Before I get into the meat of my argument, I'd like to address one quick point. There's a fatal flaw in counsel's...
Pull the microphone down a little bit.
Thank
there you.
You go. There's a flaw in counsel's argument in stating that medical expert testimony was required to prove the finger abrasion, and that's not true, primarily because medical conditions that are within the common knowledge of a layperson don't require medical expert testimony. If that were true, that we'd need a medical expert to opine as the causal relationship about the finger abrasion, well, then counsel would have lost some directed verdict because Dr. Zusi specifically said, I didn't examine or treat and could not causally relate that finger abrasion to the work incident.
Counsel, this case is like a perfect example to me of bad facts making bad law, because you've got such an extreme. So let me narrow that extremity to understand exactly what your position is. You have six claims. They win on three. They lose on three. There's separate testimony from physicians. Your position is that separate testimony, no recovery, the lost ones.
Can I clarify the question? If there are three conditions that are allowed that one doctor testifies on and three conditions that another doctor testifies on,
right,
and they're disallowed, yes, in that case, the costs that are strictly related to the disallowed conditions must be excluded from the final tally.
Even though the claimant was found to have a right to participate, and the statute doesn't say to what degree, it just says right to participate.
What right to participate means has a discrete meaning in workers' compensation law because it's a term of art. As this court decided in Ward v. Kroger, there is no such thing as a generic request to participate. Rather, it's always tethered to a specific medical condition that's narrowly defined, and compensation and benefits are payable specifically for that condition.
Okay, let's take the next scenario. One doctor testifies, all six conditions, lose on three. What's the fee?
The administrator would not argue for an apportionment in that case. We're only arguing for an apportionment where it's clearly distinct and where it's possible. So the administrator fully recognizes there are going to be many cases.
So in that argument, your definition of right to participate is different. I mean, if you're saying right to participate is a term of art, how does it change in the second scenario that Justice Stratton gave you?
Right to participate always has the same distinct meaning. It's the right to participate for specific medical conditions. Where there's a second threshold question that needs to come into play here, and that's the divisibility of claims.
There's no divisibility of claims stated in the statute. The legislature did not include that.
Paragraph F tracks a general principle of divisibility that's found in Ohio law, and that is where there are two.
Paragraph F talks about attorney's fees. Paragraph D talks about the costs of physicians and transcripts costs. So you're conflating those two sections. Under Justice Stratton's scenario, if we're to believe what you answered first, then the fact that it's the same expert but only half the claims allowed, I don't see the distinction you're making there.
Two points to make. First of all, paragraph D isn't coming into play here only because that refers to the medical expert transcripts that are filed into court, and we're not disputing that the claimant, win or lose, would get those paid for. Now, with paragraph F, it tracks a general principle of Ohio law about the divisibility of claims. So when there are two claims that can be divided into a claim for which attorneys' fees and costs are recoverable and a claim for which attorneys' fees and costs are not recoverable, the trial court must limit the litigant's recovery to that first claim.
Can you show me where the language of subparagraph F tracks the concept you've just stated?
The principle informs the language. So the language says that the trial court shall fix costs, including attorney's fees, based on effort expended when the claimant establishes a right to participate. And we know a right to participate means the right to participate for specific medical conditions.
In the scenario with the attorney fees, then, win three, lose three. Does the judge have to go through all the fee expenses and say, okay, you spent this just on these three, you spent this on these three, and what happens to this if it's something that affects all six? What is the judge's guidepost for that?
Well, we're not advocating for any kind of magic rule or some kind of apportionment formula. It's what we're advocating is that where costs and fees can be strictly related to the disallowed conditions, those must be excluded. So specifically with respect to attorney's fees, it's fully within the trial court's discretion to find that even though there are three conditions that are disallowed, I'm not going to give attorney's fees for those conditions. But it's quite likely the trial court could easily get up to that statutory cap just based on having one of three allowed conditions.
It seems that the real issue here is the discretion of the trial judge to work with F and make a determination. And in this particular case, after looking at the entire trial, the trial court made the determination to award everything. Now, that's an exercise of discretion. You're taking issue with that? Because if you are, it sounds as though you're saying the trial court must allocate. I don't see that F says that. It says the trial judge shall fix the amount.
The administrator's not asking the trial court to do anything that they're already not mandated to do by the statute. The statute says to fix costs, including attorney's fees, based on effort expended. The trial court already has that mandatory duty to go through and say, what are the costs, what's the line item, and what are they attributed to?
Well, how do you factor in effort expended? The attorney is putting forth 100% effort and doing a great job. It's just the facts aren't there, maybe the medical, whatever the jury's determination is. So how can you say that, you know, maybe the three that were allowed were no-brainers, and the other three that were disallowed, they had to have an additional effort on behalf of the attorney? I don't understand what you're asking a trial judge to do.
Well, in that situation, we're solely asking the trial court where possible. This is a very reasonable, workable rule. We're not asking the trial courts to come up with some magical apportionment.
So there's no bright line here. It's just kind of squishy.
The only thing that's the bright line is that where there are costs that are strictly related to the disallowed conditions, those must be excluded. It's certainly within the trial court's discretion to find that even if they only win one condition, maybe they're still entitled to the full $4,200.
But the 10th District didn't see things that way, correct?
In Holler? Well, they actually did award costs even though the condition was disallowed. And I think the conflict here is more a matter of degree than a full-on conflict. I guess the best analogy would be that they're in the same book but on a different page. So to the extent that the Holler court did not exclude the costs for that one medical expert deposition or his witness fee, there is a conflict.
Does the judge have the discretion to look at the fact that the claimant won everything at the administrative level and is now forced to defend, and the attorney has to expend effort to defend something that the claimant had won? Is that something they're allowed to factor into in terms of these awards?
No, and that's because when there's a 512 appeal filed, this is a trial de novo. So no matter what happened at the administrative level, it's as if the slate is wiped clean. And regardless of who files the appeal, the employer or the claimant is still the plaintiff who bears the burden of proof to go forward and prove his conditions. And I can see that my time is expired.
Ms. Erdman, before you sit down, I want to ask you a question to help understand your argument. You keep talking about based on the effort expended, and I see that phrase as modified by the claimant's right to participate or continue to participate being established. So I see the two as joined. So in the application of this case, if the maximum attorney fee is $4,200, and we had claims of a low back strain and a rotator cuff and a posterior shoulder, and all of those were disallowed, and only the skin spot on the knuckle was allowed, how would you, or what are you urging that would have been the appropriate determination of the division of the $4,200 in this case?
For the attorney's fees specifically?
Yes.
The Bureau is not advocating for any specific amount. It's just more the theory that if there are costs, including fees, that are strictly related to the disallowed conditions, this must be excluded. Now, with attorney's fees,
so you're
it's
saying
difficult.
To exclude all the attorney fees that relate to the disallowed conditions and only the attorney fees that pertain to the allowed condition?
Correct. But the administrator fully recognizes that based on just going to trial and the preparation going into it, you very well could reach that $4,200 cap.
Could you reach the $4,200 cap in this instance?
I'm sorry?
Could you reach the $4,200 allocation in this instance?
I think the trial court easily could, but we don't have that record before us because there was no line item of what the attorney's time was spent for the conditions.
What, in your view, should we write then in this case?
I would say strictly that if where possible, if the trial court can exclude costs, including attorney's fees, that are strictly related to the disallowed conditions, those must be excluded from the final tally.
And then who pays the disallowed costs, the deposition or the expert witness costs and the attorney fees? Does the claimant have to pay that?
The claimant would bear his own costs just like in any other litigation.
So the claimant would win some award, and then that award would be, in some cases, perhaps obliterated by the fact that he has to pay for defending the other half of the case.
It's consistent with the General Assembly's intent to minimize the injured worker's actual expenses incurred.
And that actually seems contrary to the intent of the Commission to do this balance where you know, a worker is allowed to pursue their action without long-term detriment.
Well, I mean, I think anybody would, no one would disagree that an injured worker who is not successful would not get costs, and the injured worker who is fully successful would get all of his costs.
Do you know what the costs were in this case?
Well, including attorney's fees, is about $12,000. So I think it was about $7,500 and then $4,200.
And your view then would be, because none of the medical expert testimony related to the finger, none of the costs are paid. And in this case, the trial court awarded the cost. Is that right?
Correct.
But isn't this more appropriate for the legislature? I mean, the workers' compensation statutes are replete with giving a financial number to whether you lose a thumb or an arm or a knee. To accept your argument, the legislature could clearly indicate the position that you're arguing in the statute. They've been very precise every place else in the workers' comp statute. You're actually asking us to read more into that section than is there.
The Bureau is not asking this court to read anything into the statute that's not reasonably implied, and that's because there's a general principle in Ohio of this divisibility of claims. So again, where there are two claims...
So you want us to read that the legislature implied your position?
That general principle of divisibility informs the statute. And so I'm not asking you to read anything that's not already in there and can't be reasonably...
implied. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mappick?
Thank you very much. Justice O'Connor, Justices of Court, I'm here representing Crawford Machine Incorporated, a company that had 100 employees at the time of this specific incident. I think the questions that were asked by the court are illustrative of the fact that in workers' compensation, nothing is bright line. These are very, very fact-specific cases. And in fact, that is why the legislature said and gave the judges discretion to look at each one of these cases and determine what costs and what fees are associated with the proof of the conditions that are alleged in the claim. Now, in this particular claim, we have a trial court who awarded essentially $12,000 for a Band-Aid. Now, in this instance, there's no evidence that the claimant expended almost $12,000 in proving that he sustained a right finger abrasion. In fact, if it were not for the conditions that the jury denied in this case, this issue of the right to a finger abrasion would not even have been before the court. It didn't even rise to the level of a workers' compensation claim.
If the jury had determined that there were no allocation for or no award for participation for the skin spot on the knuckle,
yes, Your Honor.
Could the claimant have collected any attorney fees or costs based on the effort expended?
If the jury had determined that he had not incurred that in the course and scope of his employment,
yes,
then he would have been entitled to receive nothing as far as costs and fees go. And with respect to, I wanted to address Justice Pfeiffer's question as well, whether or not the employer could have agreed to accept this one condition. In this particular case, the employer could not, because it wasn't just a standalone condition. The claimant in this particular condition, appellant was alleging that all of these conditions arose out of an electrical shock. Well, the appellant did not prove that he sustained an electrical shock. So the employer could not have agreed to accept just that condition because it would have been acquiescing that there was an electrical shock. And, in fact, the jury found that there was not an electrical shock.
But they found that he had an abrasion from some other source.
They found that because he had an abrasion on his finger and needed a Band-Aid and he was at work, evidently it occurred.
So they didn't link it to the electrocution that he alleged caused all the other conditions that he claimed he had and had testimony for?
They absolutely did not. In fact, there was a jury interrogatory that asked whether or not the claimant sustained the condition of electrical shock. And in fact, the jury interrogatory came back that no, he did not. So that's why the employer could not have acquiesced in this particular case.
But, I mean, under your set of circumstances, it is an appealing argument that this because of the complete rejection by the jury of those more significant injuries and the fact that he was only awarded for a Band-Aid knuckle. You know, it's an appealing argument that should the employer, the state, et cetera, have to pay the cost of litigation here. But is that something, as Justice McGee-Brown referenced to your co-counsel, is that something that we should, for specificity, leave to the legislature?
I would respectfully maintain that the legislature has, in fact, recognized that because workers' compensation cases are so fact-specific that they gave the trial court the discretion to award costs and fees pursuant to what the effort expended, what is tried in court, the conditions that are alleged, the conditions that are claimed, the conditions that are allowed.
But I heard that you know, there is one rule that she'd like to see that was mentioned by the appellee here, is that you won't get an award for a disallowed claim. You won't get compensation for attorney fees and medical expert fees, et cetera, that is associated, that can clearly be drawn by the trial judge to the disallowed claim.
That would be correct.
That's what you want to see.
Well, I think that makes sense, quite frankly.
It may make sense to you and me or to anybody else, but doesn't it have to make sense and be specifically stated? That's a major policy proclamation, and isn't that the role of the legislature? They could easily craft a statute that says just that.
Well, I would argue that they could have easily crafted the statute to say if you are successful on any condition whatsoever,
sure they could
that
have.
You get paid for everything. But they didn't say that. They left it to the trial court's discretion. And in this case,
the trial court awarded
abused its discretion.
Well, you say the trial court abused its discretion. Other people would look at it and said the trial court followed the statute. There was a heck of a lot of work expended here, and if it wasn't successful, that's not the determining factor. And yet you want to link it to the success of the attorney, to the success of the expert witness, not to the amount of work expended. And that's the problem I have.
Well, I would argue that it is within the trial court's discretion to determine the amount of work that is expended. And in this particular case, there was no work or very little work expended in proving a little finger abrasion. In fact, the work that was expended was with respect to whether or not there was this electrical shock, and all of these conditions were the sequelae of this electrical shock. And that's where the majority of the costs, the fees, everything came into this case.
But the problem is that the abrasion to the finger established the right to participate, according to the jury. So that's the issue. No matter how minuscule you may look at an injury of that type, it brings into play the right to participate in the fund, and then it calls into action subsection F, which gives the trial judge complete discretion. So, you know, that's the problem that we see. And I think Justice Stratton is right. You know, a difficult case or facts that seem strange creating what may appear to be the opposite of what common sense would say, but we also must look at the language of the statute.
And I agree that we have to look at the language of the statute, but I think we also have to look at the intent of the statute. And the intent of the statute, it was that because they put in there the judicial discretion that it would be our argument that not just one condition allows you to get all attorney's fees and all costs.
So we accepted this on a conflict between two districts. If this were a direct appeal, you'd basically just be arguing abuse of discretion by the trial court. That's really what your argument is, that the trial judge abused his or her discretion in awarding the totality of the damages or the expenses.
That's the underlying facts, but however, there is a conflict here between this court, Third District Court of Appeals decision in Holmes and the court's decision in Holler.
Oh, I get that conflict. I'm saying if we were here just on a permissive jurisdictional, your argument would solely be abuse of discretion. That appears to be what you're arguing.
That would be our argument if we were here in that case. However, we also recognize that there's absolutely this conflict, and we feel that based upon the judicial intent or excuse me, the legislative intent and the plain reading of the statute, that, and the again underscoring that there is judicial discretion and that a claim does not mean, as my co-counsel said, there it's a term of art, and that we don't believe that the legislature intended to permit the complete recovery of fees and costs for a claim that that for which there were no fees and costs.
So do you envision then there would be a series of hearings to determine the appropriate award?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there would be a series of hearings. I think our trial judges are intelligent enough, and certainly this trial judge who sat in on this case would be intelligent enough to hear the evidence on this case, what was expended. Even though the trial judge heard this case, he had no firsthand knowledge of all or any of the efforts that were expended.
But that's not done now, is it, on the issue of the awards under Section F?
The judge can hold a hearing if they
do. They routinely hold hearings on this stuff?
Quite frankly, this is not an issue that really comes up all that much because, number one, if there is a condition that is generally not allowed, you don't have the discrepancy that you do in this particular case. For example, in Holler, they were two back conditions, and a doctor can testified to two back conditions. Certainly, it was within the judge's discretion to award the appellant or the claimant the fees in that. But in other cases, the court should have wider discretion. I think that was legislative intent.
Thank you.
You referenced the conflict between the 3rd District and the 10th Appellate District. Has your research developed that there are other appellate districts that have weighed in on this subject one way or the other?
There are other appellate districts that have weighed in.
How is it being handled in those districts?
It's my understanding that it is being handled in various ways. There's no consistent approach to the way the question of fees and costs are being handled.
Is it being handled in other districts differently from the 3rd or the 10th? Is there a third way or another way that they're doing it, to your knowledge?
I've not seen a third way of handling this. It's either within the judge's discretion to look at the facts and award pursuant to effort expended, or it is the bright line which the appellant is asking you to draw, and that is that no matter what, if you win on one condition, you get all of your costs and all of your fees.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Lothar, you've saved almost 2 minutes.
Okay. Ms. Lothar, are you actually asking us to draw a line to say that in a situation like this you get all your costs and all your fees? I thought you were saying that it's a matter of discretion with a trial judge.
According to the statute, it's a matter of discretion with the trial judge.
Because in Boother, for example, or Boer, the case that is the conflict, in that case, the trial judge actually determined to allocate. The Court of Appeals said, we affirm because there's no abuse of discretion.
Correct.
So in a situation like this, your judge could have determined to make an allocation, and that would have been within the trial judge's discretion. Would you agree?
Correct. And then we'd be up here on whether it was an abuse of discretion or not.
That's the point I wanted to make. We're not talking about drawing bright lines in as much as we're saying leave it to the trial judge to follow the statute.
Correct. And, you know, and what the statute says, though, well, first of all, the purpose of the statute is to minimize the actual expense incurred by an injured worker by going to who wins at trial. Under F, there is no hearing required. Okay, so we can't put words into a statute that the legislature didn't have there. That Justice asked about other districts and how they're handling it. The 5th District in Asbell in 2008, there's one condition won and 3 conditions lost. The parties agreed to attorney's fees. which didn't happen here, but not to the costs. In that case, one expert testified on all conditions, and what this trial or court of appeals found is that it would be difficult, if not impossible, for the trial court to determine what percentage of the doctor's testimony was relevant to a particular injury. It would equally be difficult to then determine a percentage of apportionment for medical expert fees and costs. Said winning one condition made him a successful claimant entitled to full reimbursement for all reasonable costs associated with the litigation. And the judges in the Fifth District believe that that conclusion is in accordance with the philosophy behind the workers' compensation statutes, which say you have to interpret these liberally in favor of injured workers. I don't think that we can have some type of rule that, well, sometimes you can apportion if you can, and if you can't, then don't worry about it. Okay, that's not what the statute says. And I think that this court is bound by the limits of the statute, and that we need to answer, that the court needs to answer the certified question in the negative.
Counsel, there is one argument that you haven't addressed yet, and I'd like to hear your opinion on it. And that is that in order to participate, it has to be based on a specific allowed condition. So the right to participate is tied to a specific condition. And there's a well-known principle of statutory interpretation that you read statutes together when you do it. So you have one that says you can only participate for an allowed condition. Then you have a statute that doesn't say specifically where you get it for all or nothing. So their argument is, well, you have to read those two together so you're only allowed for attorney fees and court costs for an allowed condition, unless they're sort of meshed together and you can't, you know, separate them, and then you get everything. So what is your response to that?
I believe that if you're speaking of the Ward case, under the Ward case that dealt with the right to participate for a specific condition when it came to, you know, when you appeal something to the, you know, under a 512. I don't believe that when it comes to the statute for attorney's fees and costs, that if the legislature wanted to include that language, they would have. You know, they recently amended this to, you know, increase the amount of attorney's fees. They certainly had the opportunity at that point that they could have added that language if they thought it was necessary.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you.